tonight, and thank you to Paul for hosting us again. I think this is the fourth year that we've been here and showcasing the work of the MA students. This terrific group of writers have been working together since September, so this is a wonderful time to really showcase their work. And one of the things that we try to do on the programme is to encourage writers to feel that they are writers, which can actually be very, very hard when you're starting out, when you are putting new work out there. So I'm very grateful to Paul and everyone at Obeah for giving us such a wonderful platform in which we can feel comfortable with our own authority and our sense of ourselves as writers. So we have seven, I think we have seven. Can I ask, is Una here?
Yes.
No, not you. The other Una.
The other,
yeah.
And we don't know.
Una Hennessy. No, so I think we actually have six tonight, but there'll be no shortage of wonderful poets. So the first poet that I'm going to introduce is Laura McKenna. Laura is writing historical fiction for her PhD, which she's been writing poetry for some time now. Her work has been nominated for a Hennessy Award, and her poem Perspective, published in the Irish Examiner Tuesday Poem Slot, was nominated for a Forward Prize in 2016. So Laura. Hello. The first poem I'm going to read was written in response, I think it was a journey poem. A journey poem was the sort of premise for this. And the particular topic arose from seeing a Brent goose actually in Coolock Bay on the Bear Peninsula in October, I think. So a single Brent goose, and that's what sparked the poem. So it's called Brent. What then is the signal to go? The sun low in its arc, the yellowing moss, or the drift of downy white, a scrim of ice on tundra pools? Do you shuffle forward, seaward, ruffle feathers, ruck, ruck, stretch your wings, out, up? Is it the pull of go, the push of fly, the open sky that leads to this, beat on beat over the seas of Baffin Bay, coasting the fjords of Greenland, soaring over ice caps, heart pumping to push, push to 3,000 metres, find the current to bring you down the Denmark Strait to Iceland, a time at least to feed on eel grass. Then gather the last reserves, fly low, follow the stars, or is it the sun that spurs you on through Atlantic gales to land at last at Strangford Lock, or a stretch of Darndale wasteland to graze with travellers' piebalds? So what went wrong that brings just one to Coolock Bay in September, where your fellows pray to kestrels or hunters' guns in Iceland? Or did your compass point you here for a solitary journey's end? The next one is called Latent World. The road to Corbenny Cross, drowsy with mist, making ghosts of familiar trees, no breeze, no smells, no birdsong, the rookery by Ford's farm now still. Only cows call out unseen from smothered fields like lonely foghorns. Cars pass slowly, their lights puzzling the distance and swallowed in a glow of red. Up close, the gorse is hammocked with cobwebs, the hedge a beaded geometry, synaptic threads connecting leaf to tree to telephone pole. And every blade of grass holds a drop, a perfect dewdrop, a world inverted. And the last poem is called Baby Chino. I saw a child in Costa today, sitting in a high chair, a china cup and saucer on the tray before her. While the mother talked, the child gripped the handle in a delicate pincer, her fingers winging as she dipped her head to the milky froth. I watched her hand hover in the space between air and the plane of the tray, saw her place cup on saucer with all the grace of a tightrope walker, the wonder of it. Thank you.
Our next reader is Paul Asta. Paul was born in South Korea. He's a bookbinder and a writer from the Chicago suburbs. And we're delighted that he was able to be here on Fulbright Fellowship to study with us on the MA program.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm so thankful to meet with my peers here. It's been strange being so far away from home, wherever that is. Some of my friends here know, although I'm from the Chicago suburbs and born from Korea, I come from a little bit of a strange family. I have an Italian father, a Norwegian and Swedish mother, half Puerto Rican and German brother, and two Chinese sisters. So when we go out to eat for dinner, we look like a little UNICEF box. So it's and all of us children are adopted. So it's an interesting group. And so I have two poems here. That kind of has nothing to do with either one of my poems. That's just my small talk for that. But okay, so this poem kind of has to deal with my adoption a little bit, but this is called Lullaby for the Wandering Child. Tell him he was born a goldfish, and you called him Marmalade, because his tail fin reminded you of your grandmother's butter knife inserted and spun about the jar, which she held with a loose grip and trembling hands. And it wasn't the mess afterwards that worried you. It was the pouring and the tremble. The way the light came in through the kitchen window and the jar of marmalade glowed clandestine and ricocheted amber all over the blue kitchen walls. And when he asks why he was born a goldfish, tell him how you held him to the sky, hoping the sky would seem miraculous, jubilant even, how quickly the night approaches. And though he will find no answers in the stars, and though this will not comfort him, tell him he was a small boy with mercurial features, born in equinox, that you found him on land that was no good, the dirt trodden, the grass raised from gravel, the gravel too dense to walk on. And tell him how the sky that day was cut from its stalk, and he stood before you like a bird with both wings broken, a violin in the rain slowly pulled against the landscape. And when he is done asking his questions, and when you find there's nothing left to say, send him down to the water and let him find his own way home. So this is a happier poem, maybe? I've spent most of my life in the Chicago suburbs, in this sort of Chicago base, but we're in Ireland, so I picked the wrong poem. Where are we? I don't know. Maybe I'm misplaced. So this is called Where You Left Her. You met on the CTA bus. She lived three blocks over, four houses down, played violin for the past 16 years and hated it. Earlier, she had asked you if you could curl your lips Chicago style, and you tried desperately to imagine what that would look like. She told you to imagine your teeth were the skyline, some buildings taller than others, some in desperate need of repair. How your gold molar reminded her of the Christmas tree ornaments in the holiday windows at Marshall Fields. Damn, she said, a different time, and forgot to mention the lips. Most of the commute was quiet, the slow shuffle, the doors on the bus opening and closing, abbreviated motions in which the people around you excused each other as they touched in the smallest ways. She would work herself to a point, give you these small moments, and then get lost in her own thoughts. And you had thought there was a sort of comfort to that, to sit in that place together. Maybe it was the way the yellow book sat on the doorstep for 3 months. How the condensation seemed to warp everything. The names, the addresses, the coupons all meshed together, creating a sort of pulp. An amalgamation of the surrounding area all coalesced in the same place at the same time. And maybe it wasn't that comfortable at all. And you remember how in the winter the wind came off the lake and dried out everything. How the air made your nose bleed in the morning, like breathing a forest. Every tree splintering, every pine needle puncturing your lungs, the corners of your mouth folding and unfolding, adjusting to the cold winter air. And you remember how you had planned to take her to Chinatown, but her mom called and told her not to go to the south side. So you went up north and had hot dogs instead. And maybe it was the hot dogs, or maybe it was the atmosphere. But you remember leaving her there, the salt licking away the snow from the sidewalks. Thank you.
Lynch is our next poet. Mona is from Cork and is the mother of 5 children, which is a heroic career in itself. She took her first poetry class on the 12th of September, but you actually wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it's her first poetry class, and you wouldn't believe I had anything to do with it, because her work has moved us all so much in the workshop, and I'm delighted that you're here to share it tonight. Thank you.
This first poem was inspired by that first class where Leanne came in and sat down and wasn't that happy with the room, and she said, "I want a mahogany table." So it stuck. The student and the poet. "I want to learn to rhyme," said the student. "I want a mahogany table," said the poet. They got their tools and began. They worked with words and boards. "Prepare the wood till the grain appears," he said. "Find the word within the word," she said. They cut and trimmed, they honed and planed, they matched up all the grain. The words they teased until they fit. "What are lyrics and metaphors?" asked the student. "What's a mortis and tenon?" asked the poet. "They keep the rails together," said the student. "They add music and breath," said the poet. She French polished until it glowed, and from him a new language flowed. Continuing with woodwork, I don't know why. This is called The Plane. He shaved with the grain, holding it steady with both hands, always planing the face side first. Like curls being shorn, shavings fell around the bench. He loved his wood, honing, planing, stroking it like a lover, never satisfied until it felt like silk. His favorite perfume, the resin from deal, or the spicy aroma of cedarwood. He called me once to witness a rare event. He was turning eucalyptus. Its potent aroma filled the shed. His plane now lies idly on its side. Hammers, chisels, saws, a requiem chorus along the wall. Today, I hung it on a safe hook, high on the wall beside his father's plane. They lie together now, father and son, surrounded by yew and pine, up on the hill behind the church, where as a lad he carved Celtic crosses at the end of every bench. This is a a small, serious poem. One day Leanne said, I want you to do a poem about truth. And it's called Truth. I love truth the way I love ordinary things. A field undisturbed after a fall of snow behind the house. A sea of iridescence swirling through my curtains to steal my sleep. Let it not lie like a pall, an ending. Come sheep, come cattle, or even a tiny robin. Make your mark like a row of stitching on a pristine cloth.
Indiana, is a writer and poet interested in travel and the arts, and she's currently working on a collection of short stories and poems. So, just to preface, this first poem, I recently was married at the end of December, and this was originally supposed to be part of ceremony, and then it wasn't done to my taste and time. So that's okay, but this is called Walk Slow. I would like to be back in bed, yielding a thick potter's mug of peppermint tea beside you. Instead, I stand just behind the doors to the sanctuary, waiting for my cue to waltz down the aisle. My father's arm held out at an angle, the crook like a shepherd's hook, meant to keep me from straying too far away. Soon, he will set my hand in yours. The pass complete, I will tiptoe up the remaining steps and heels, my attempt to lessen the drastic difference in our heights. I will say a silent prayer about the feathers daintily dangling from my dress, their tips spraying outwards, caught in a web of static cling, leaning to be close to you. Across the Atlantic, a quiet space will wrap cotton sheets and wool blankets about our shoulders. We will traipse through galleries and tuck into Aphrodite's cupboard, sifting through ingredients for the decadent and delicate. We will curl up with a book and rest after I am unpinned from my father's arm. And then this last one is from an exercise in class, and it just happened. She could be anywhere. I saw her hips in the doorways, her hair in the sunlight, her eyes in the darkness, and her lips in the rain. She was a goddess of the most potent nature. Her body became another fixture in the house, a tree in the wood, a light pole on my walk home from the pub. She appeared in the most remarkable guises, masks fashioned from the heads of flowers, daisies made up her eyes. Using catgut for thread and an old nail as a needle, she stretched pelts and knit them together in a techno-animal cape. How she sharpened this instrument was a mystery. Night after night, she came to my window, pausing before passing through my wall, sometimes catching her ankles on the studs in the building frame, and sometimes appearing without warning, her shrieks piercing the veil, ripping through this and that dream, trapping me in a gorge filled with bodies dismembered, spare parts for spare people. Years working as a producer with RTÉ Radio 1, Jackie took voluntary redundancy to focus on her creative work. And at the moment, she's working on a number of creative projects while doing her MA with us at UCC. She says she's very new to poetry, but I think we'll agree. But again, I find it very hard to believe because the journey has been wonderful to witness.
So.
when I started the MA in September, coming into October, I kept seeing these leaves around the ground on campus, these odd-shaped leaves that were like sycamore leaf, but more curvy around the edges. And I did a bit of research and discovered this incredible tree. Lyriodendrotulipifera is the official title. It has lots of nicknames. But it turned out that this tree is an example of this tree is the biggest living thing in New York City. And there are two of them that kind of vie for the title of biggest living tree. One of them is in a very nice kind of neat park, and the other is in the middle of nowhere, and you have to climb through mesh fences to find it, and there's kind of a little casual sign, and that's the one that won the title. Tulip tree. A leaf slants down, pauses, glides a last stroke to the ground. Leathery orange yellow, curved, smoother than sycamore, your own, your own. From tulip tree and whitewood, you fiddlestick of uncetia, giant breaking through to light, climbing through dark pools. Your monumental arms taper down, cupping sticky finger buds, clasping messages in your leaves, folded letters waiting to be read. Did they carve boats from your thighs to take you here? Did they light fire in your tulip candles, flickering a pathway through the waves? Or was it threaded bees who led you to here to fatten in a courtyard, mud-streaked pages pushed into the ground, the footsteps, the footsteps? Your brother and sister send letters, I hope. Do their calls ever reach you? They go unnoticed now, though the Queen's giant still calls out as cars race by. Of course, the Clove Lake Colossus tries to reach her leggy heights, but as is the way, his belly grows, though still he remembers Abraham Lincoln. Clove Lake craved laddering stars, though your sister never cared for such things. She is lonely now. Sometimes she thinks she can hear music on the air, the sweeter tones that used to reach from organ pipes. I fear it is the sound of traffic passing, peaking, fading, car after car after car. This poem is about the sort of resonance that sometimes inanimate objects have. Two of my own children were born at home in a birthing pool, and when I tried to sell the house on a couple of occasions, I felt I couldn't sell this space that seemed to resonate in some way. But this poem isn't about that space. This is about a house where, well, you'll hear what happened in this house, and it's just a very different energy, obviously. House. Sun breaks through from the garden, weaves rays that pierce the house, reaches the largest front window. It is morning of that day, of that day. The people have not yet arrived. And then, unraveling, the people come. And later, the house begins to vibrate to a tinkle of glasses, a cheer, a ball putted, and then to the inhale, exhale rhythm of breathing water. The rhythm of a drowning child. Again, again, the panic builds. At first, it is a murmuring, like an old train approaching, and then, again, a piercing wail breaks from the garden, tears into the house, shatters the large window as waves of water crash into every room. All in its wake is lifted. Furniture, a gramophone, breakfast bowls, platters of canapes, and families come through the window that disintegrates on impact. And all of them screaming now. Chairs, the tables, the beds, the teaspoons, the flapping, wailing books, the people. Until, again, it stops. The survivors and their injuries crawl from the wreckage, reversing onto feet, plucking themselves from their own spilt blood, and one by one they are swept up again as all rewinds. The windows reassemble behind the last finger, a final sweep of hair slithers through, cups, teapots, pages unscramble, splinters realign, the pillows suck in feathers. Order is restored until sun breaks through again, weaves in from the garden on the morning of it all, before they arrive, reaching the front window, which starts to wobble with a noise like a train and the shuddering vibrations. And this last one was inspired by, there's a pub that I pass on my way home every day, and there's a little pet farm attached to the pub. And one day as I was passing, there were two sheep in the middle of the field, just cupped together. And the poem opens with a quote from the Bible. And the sheep follow him, for they know his voice, and a stranger will they not. And the sheep follow him, for they know his voice, and a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. John chapter 10, verses 1 to 5. Pet farm. Two sheep curve around each other as held hands, ample backsides on them, a long sweep of hips, tipped into each other like embracing buxom lovers. Outside the day passes, a crowd goes about their pointing, calling. The sheep watch the ground, stay settled in their private selves. It is mild here, the lowlands. They are not yearning for heat. They are miles from snowy mountains, many miles from bitter cold. But they hunker down together, listening for a shepherd's call, waiting, hooked and latched, for woodcock and a blizzard. They could get up and walk about, go graze the moderate grass. Instead, they are on standby for the end of the world. Perhaps they have ancient wisdom. They know something we do not. Stock still they lie, a secret ear flick, hearing or listening, waiting, waiting.
Thank you, Jackie. And Una Hennessy, our last poet for a minute. So our last poet this evening is Alessandra Tobin. Alessandra is a poet and short fiction writer from Boston, Massachusetts. She has been previously published, or has work forthcoming, in the Albion Review, the Corryman, Atticus, and Curbside Splendor, and was awarded the Douglas A. Quinta Award, and she's currently working on her first collection. Alessandra.
This first one is about, or I guess in the voice of...
You need to stand closer to the mic or speak louder.
Okay, am I close enough?
Perfect.
Yes, okay. So, no. Yes. Is it? Okay. Yeah, is it? Okay. but yeah, so this first poem, I have two, is in the voice of Kate Donahue, who is the third and final wife of the American poet John Berryman, who she married him when she was much younger than him. And she was also, unfortunately, a heavy alcoholic like her father, and he ended up killing himself by jumping off of a bridge and suffocating in the mud in 1972. So this is called Kate Donahue, 1973. The sky is the color of old paper. Your life was a housefly with oil slick skin who sought water but died ugly, mouth and nose filled with river mud. In the middle of my chest is a small bird shot by an arrow. Isn't it stupid to think so? All of the people who live here have seen me pass in front of their windows at least once, never out of anger. There are people I want to tell, come home, but every night I lock the doors. It is not enough just to love, it is not enough just to love, it is not enough. You who are nearly as old as my father, you who are twice as drunk as my father, you who wished my father dead, every night I thank God a child never loved you. There is only honey on my fang and only ever my own blood. Kiss it and make it much better. Listen, why don't flies burn when they buzz into light bulbs? Today I saw dark purple flowers the shape of moths. Every window in the house is filled with glass bottles. He kissed the scar on my wrist and my black stone ring. That meant something to me. I write it down and feed the paper to the sand. And the second one is about the Georgia O'Keeffe painting that is called Deer Skull with Pedernal. It's just a painting of a deer skull hanging on a tree with this mountain in the background that she loved that was called Pedernal. So it's called Deer Skull with Pedernal. Georgia O'Keeffe left her old-hearted husband for the mountain. God told her if she painted it enough, she could have it. She crowns Pedernal with antlers curved open like an unlocked door. The deer's dead anger hoisted against the swept sky, tongueless, watching the old men below scattering the bones of their wives' past dogs. Blue through eye sockets where black tree bark should be, she is making a skull for Masawa once more, thanking his bone eyes for staying open, for letting her and Silas drag their bodies to Pedernal. The mesa with its one dry peak raised, ready to bring the sky maker home, breath catching in the lock of the mountain's door. Thank you.
Thank you so much. First of all, just thank you again to Paul for giving us this platform here once a year. Really is a wonderful opportunity to to have the writers showcase their work and, to feel like real writers and get to know the Cork community as well. As you see, we have poets from all over Cork and all over, and coming from the States as well. So it really is wonderful to get to know the community here. And I'd like to thank our poets as well, and I'd like you to join me in giving them one last round of applause.